Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot brought to you from Eretz HaKedesh is daf Tet Zayin, and we're holding right at the Halakha Mishnah, and it's going to offer us a lovely review of the series of issues that we had in the previous perek, because it introduces a new way of looking at some of these issues, as we'll see, and that is this. Remember that until now we've been talking about this big machlokas between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer on one side and Rabbi Yoshua on the other, right? And what it is that this revolved around were numerous issues. I mean, on the surface, it was a question of Bori Veshema and whether we say even so, Lo Mipia Anu Chayin. When we dug a little deeper, we understood that it revolves also around the question of how seriously we take the Gezerah of Chumra Lagabe Yuchasim, and that itself was part of a search for a mechanism. And there the question was, will we rely also on the additional evidence of a Migu or on the Chazaka that she had a Cheskes Kashrus, and is there strong enough to even say, together with the Bori, that will even be motzi mamon from the cheskas adam who has that money, and so on and so forth. So there was a quite complex issues. Suppose we change the formula a little bit, and instead of simply throwing in a migo, we introduce a new issue. The new issue is the question of hapesha asar hu hape shehitir. So that is a sort of a migo. And according to some, the main way in which it works is through the same idea of amigo. However, it's more powerful. According to Rashi, it's really a new halacha. We'll see that there are subtle differences between a standard migo and a pesha asar. The meaning of a pesha asar is that, according to Rashi at least, is that without the testimony of the very person who brought up the issue, we never would have been able to bring it up. So suppose somebody goes over to you and says, you know, this house that I'm living in used to belong to your dad. Really? Says you. So give it back. Right? Okay. There's no, I bought it from him. It used to belong to your dad. So, I mean, what are we going to say over there? That the hodas baldin kamei aidim dami. Well, you admit that it belonged to my dad, so therefore give it to me? Of course not. What we say is, hapesh asar hu hapesh yitir. If you brought it up, so then, of course, we're going to have to believe your definition of how it is that you meant it when you said it belonged to your dad. And any time that you come along and say, well, of course I said it belonged to your dad. I was just telling you over the history of the house, for heaven's sakes. Obviously, I bought it for him. And what do you think, I'm an idiot? I'm going to tell you that I stole a house from your father since you could come and sue me? So that's called hapesh asar. Since it's a pesha asar, then whatever he says was meant by that pesha asar, we accept. Which goes beyond the simple question of amigo, well, you could have said something better. Because over here, we don't have a case other than building upon your words. Now, there's major differences if that's the case. If this is not amigo, for instance, if you've got amigo, then you have to be able to say within toch kedei dibor, you have to be able to adjust your taina within the time that you could have said that migo. If you come along and you talk about it at some other time, we're not going to believe you. Mashain came by a pesha asra, a pesha hiter. If it did 5 years later, the guy says, didn't you say in front of witnesses that this house belonged to my father? Yeah, but I meant I bought it from him. Well, obviously, we're still going to believe what you have to say, right? Because we don't have a case other than based on your own words. So there are many subtle differences that actually come into play as we go through the perek. The perek is going to be talking about a lot of different cases of apesha asar. So basically what our first Mishnah does is it analyzes the additional, of course, all of this is between the lines. We have to carefully parse the Mishnah into all of the issues that it's involved with. Turns out that it hints to us with some very strong hints at what it's trying to do, that it's forcing us to re-examine if we have the same case that we had in the previous perek, but this time it is also involving the woman's bringing up the issue in the first place, then indeed we have perhaps a situation where even Rabbi Yoshua, who wanted to be Machmer, where we have a Migo, we have a Chazaka together with a Bori, Afal Pikein, he says in the previous parak that because of the special consideration that the Chumrah of Mala also be Yuchsin, in this case, if you even have a Pesha Yitir, then we will, according to him as well, rely on it. That actually seems to be the way that the Mishnah is constructed, as we'll see in a moment. So, again, on the surface, the Mishnah isn't clear at all. There's so many issues that are involved here that unless you tell me carefully what we're talking about, I don't know what you're trying to say. But we have a case over here of Aisha Shinit Armala Onid Garsha. So, we have normally, we have a ktuvah, is a written document, and it says over there precisely how much money you're going to get. 100, 200, which is the Iker ktuvah. Then if there's any tosefet, that's something else. We're not talking about the tosefet. What we're talking about over here is a woman who is coming to collect her ktuvah, and she doesn't have her shtar ktuvah. Now we're going to see if she doesn't have a shtar ktuvah, what right she has to collect a ktuvah. That's a complicated question, which we'll get to. But for some reason, she doesn't have a shtar ktuvah. Maybe she says her ktuvah is lost, let's say. So now they start arguing. She says, you married me when I was a betula, and therefore my ktuvah was 200. He or his heirs, he could say in the case of a divorce, his heirs say it in the case of his death, they say or he says, not true. Dad married you when you had been previously married, or I married you before I divorced you. I married you as an almana, and I only owe you 100 zuz. So im yesh edim sheyatzat behinuma v'rosha parua. So now there used to be a minhag that they would take out a betulah in a different way to the chuppah than they would take an almana. And we'll see there were many different minhagim. One of these minhagim is that if she was a petulah, they had her hair hanging down, and it was all curly and sweet and so on. They wanted to show that she is a completely untouched woman. The other one is that she went out in a hinuma. Now, the Gemara is going to discuss different approach. What exactly is a hinuma? But whatever it is, it's something that was done only to a petulah. I want to see later on there were other minhagim, such as throwing popped wheat, or opening up a barrel of wine, different issues. But whatever they are, if it's something that was done only for a betulah, then that's good enough. And with on the basis of that testimony, we have Adim, indeed, she's able to collect ktuvah matai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says, you don't need something as big as a hinuma. Even if they were mechalei klayot, even if they throw this puffed wheat or whatever the grain is that they, you remember the old Quaker, I'm sure they must have canceled it now in a woke world. I mean, how can pacifists have this big advertisement that says shot from guns? Can you imagine? Oh my gosh. And you claim pacifism. In any event, look it up on the internet. See the old ads from Quaker Oats. You'll never believe it. These are the Quakers shot from guns. Anyway. But that's what it means when it's klayot. It's been basically parched over the fire. And that was also done only for the betula. It sort of freezes its sweetness in the grain forever. So I guess a betula is supposed to always be super sweet. Anyway, but whatever the simen is, it's a nice simen. Now, we have over here a very weird statement, which is, and Rabbi Yoshua is moda, that if we were talking about a case where somebody comes over and says, you know, this field used to belong to your dad, but I bought it from him, that over there, he is believed. Shapesh asar huapesh yitir. I mean, you brought it up. I never asked you. You're going to just shut up. On the other end, if there are witnesses, yesh edim shishel aviv, and then he claims, well, I bought it from him. In that case, eino ne'eman, you can't just say that it's mine. Fine. So now the question is, what in the world Rabbi Yoshua is doing here? We didn't talk about any. What do you mean, Moda Rabbi Yoshua? Which Rabbi Yoshua? To which Rabbi Gamliel? It's very, very unclear. So that means that we're introducing something that seems to be related to the previous perek. That's what gives us the key to understanding the distinction over here. Fine. Now, what we're saying over here is that the only reason that she can collect as a betula is because there are witnesses that she went out be'numa and so on, Rosh HaParua or Chiluk Loyot. So far we've seen in the Mishnah, and that's the only reason, which implies that if there weren't witnesses to that effect, that then we would have believed the husband or the heirs of the husband that she only gets emana because she was maybe or really an almana. So does that mean that this Stam Mishnah is not going Aliba to Rebbe Gamliel? Didn't Rebbe Gamliel say that in a case where she says something, she's always believed against her husband? Now, we said all those Mishnayos before. So I said, come on, what in the world are you talking about? What does this have to do with Rebbe Gamliel? That's off the wall. Rebbe Gamliel was talking about a case of Bori Veshema. Now you're coming along and asking a dumb question that it was as if, let's ignore the Bori Veshema, let's ignore the Chazaka, let's ignore the Migu, and let's just say, well, Rebbe Gamliel holds, we always believe a woman. I mean, that's nutty. Where did Rebbe Gamliel ever say such a thing? Over here we have two people, each one is Bori. He's saying 100%, I'm telling you, when I married you, you were not a betula. She's saying 100% I was a betula. What does that have to do with Rebbe Gamliel? How can anybody ask that question? It's utterly stupid. What do you mean, Rebbe Gamliel? There's nothing to do with Rebbe Gamliel. What was he thinking? I mean, obviously, there's got to be something over here that would involve us initially with understanding Rebbe Gamliel. Now, of course, we know that there's something very suspicious about this Mishnah, because it does say at the end of the Mishnah, Moda Rebbe Yoshua, as if there's a Rebbe Gamliel in the Mishnah that he's talking to. And that's why it's very important for us to understand what's going on. It turns out that the one who asks the question is asking it in a very special way, because he's trying to get us to see that, of course, in this case, Rebbe Gamliel is Moda, you see? And that would make everything parallel. In other words, if I'm telling you it's Stam Mishnah, and up until now we assume that Rebbe Gamliel, Rebbe Eliezer held that she was Ne'emenet. So then it would make sense to say, well, in this case, apparently Rebbe Gamliel doesn't argue. So then when we get to the end of the Mishnah, all of a sudden it starts to make sense. And in this case, Rebbe Yoshua doesn't argue. So we have a Resh and a Seifa in which there's no argument. The problem is that there's got to be a basis for saying that Rebbe Gamliel is not arguing. I mean, because on the face of it, it has nothing to do with Rebbe Gamliel. So how could it possibly introduce, well, in this case, I'm not arguing. I mean, it's not even similar to the cases that we spoke about, you see. So the brilliance of this question is to force us to understand that there is, in fact, a need for an intelligent analysis of why I would have thought that Rebbe Gamliel would argue, and therefore the Mishnah is telling us that Rebbe Gamliel doesn't argue, because that would excuse the bringing in of Rebbe Yoshua. So it means that the Mishnah was giving us a very subtle hint at the issues that we need to think about at the beginning of the Mishnah, you see? So the Gemara is constructed in a very brilliant way. So we pretend, what a stupid question. Because if we can't explain why it's not a stupid question, then we can't explain why there's any chiddush that Rebbe Gamliel is agreeing. So that's what the Gemara is doing over here. So now I'll explain to you why I would have thought that this is not like Rebbe Gamliel until it's finally explained to me that in this case, Rebbe Gamliel is Meida. Now, Barnea wants us to go over this again, but we just did, because the Mishnah is doing it again, and basically is going over the entire past parak, as we'll see, by giving us these hints. So maybe it's time for him to erase the again and to start over with something new. Anyway, v'chaim. So ask the Gemara, so what did anybody think? How did anybody get mixed up and think that this has something to do with Rabbi Gamaliel? Ah, because kivan derov nashim betulot nisod, I might have thought, you see, that we should believe her as if she said Bori and he said Shema. Why? Because the bottom line assumption is that most women who are getting married as betulot. And therefore, it's sort of like, well, that's for sure our assumptive analysis here. So therefore, her taina is the equivalent of a bori, and his taina relative to hers is merely a shema. That's what I might have thought, as I explained, because we're just looking to cover all of the angles of why it would be that Rabbi Gamliel wouldn't argue in this case. And therefore, I would have thought it's kibori v'shema. Look, it's got to be that there is a chiddush here, aliba the Rabbi Gamliel, because if the end of the Mishnah says, Miniktani, Moda Rabbi Yoshua, the first part of the Mishnah has got to be discussing a Moda Rabbi Gamliel, right? Because otherwise, who's Rabbi Yoshua Moda to? About what? Where? We never talked about this case. What are you telling me, this crazy case? Guy comes who says, this field belonged to your father. What in the world is this doing over here in the middle of Ksuvas? It sounds absolutely a non sequitur. Ah, but if we can justify the beginning of the Mishnah as actually discussing a Moda Rabbi Gamliel, and there's a chiddush in it, which I've just explained to you, that it would be similar to Bori v'Shema, then the last part of the Mishnah makes sense. The last part of the Mishnah says Moda Rabbi Yeshua. So now, if you're going to admit to me that Rabbi Gamliel is actually the author of the Reisha, and he is saying, look, I'm ready to agree to you, Rabbi Yoshua, that if it isn't a full scale Bori v'Shema supported by Amigo, that then I don't actually believe her. So then she's going to need witnesses. Okay, fine. So then if you're going to tell me there's a chiddush and Rabbi Gamliel is saying, I admit that you, Rabbi Yoshua, in this case, you're right. So then it makes sense to continue on in the safe and to say, and Rabbi Yoshua also admits that Rabbi Gamliel, who generally would agree that we would go ahead with a Bori v'Shema when supported by Amigo, so then it makes sense. And in this case, it's better because it's a Pesha Asar Hu HaPesha Hitir. Very good. But if you're going to tell me that I'm stupid for asking the question of, does this mean that Rabbi Gamliel over here, that Mishnah is not like Rabbi Gamliel, then you don't have any explanation of the end of the Mishnah, you see. So obviously you're going to need to answer my question and not just throw me out. That's the point. So then, Yamrit Loi, Rabbi Gamliel Bemoda, that the Rabbi Gamliel is not talking about a case at all because it's irrelevant to his being Maida. Why does he have to be Maida? It has nothing to do with the case he was talking about because it's that it's Bori Vabori. So then how are you going to explain the fact Rabbi Yoshua is Maida? Who is he Maida? Maida to who? Made it to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Who is he made it to? What are you bringing up, Rabbi Yoshua Modeh? That's the point. Now, wait a minute. Guys, I mean, you're pretending that this has nothing to do with the previous perek. Like, we're all starting a new issue. I mean, let's not get so caught up in the way that the Mishnayos are separated into different prokim. Can't Rabbi Yoshua just be referring back to his previous machlokas, Rabbi Gamliel, in the previous perek, where there was this whole question about how much we would rely on Amigo? Wasn't that an important case in the previous parak? We had all of those issues where she could have said a better taina, and because of that, Rabbi Gamliel says, okay, so we're going to rely on her since we also have a Bori, and Rabbi Yoshua says, no, I don't think Amigo is good enough to rely on her. So therefore, Rabbi Yoshua is saying, in this case, where you have a Pesha Asra, Pesha Hitir, well, now that is the kind of Migo even I would go for. That's a super Migo. Maybe that's all that it means, you know? What? Okay, just explain to me. You're telling me that he's referring to Migo. Can you tell me which case in the previous parak we used a Migo that is somehow similar and that this, he wants to tell us, is a better Migo? This is our beautiful Chazorah of the cases in the previous parak. So the Gemara is going to go through the various Mishnayos that we had in the previous parak, which provides us a wonderful review and an ability to take it to the next step. So let's assume that we're talking about the Mishnah on Daf Yud Gimel. Case over there is that she's pregnant, and we ask her, so where did this child come from? So she says, oh, well, the father is this Kohen, great Yichus, there's no problem. So Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer say she's an Amenet. Rabbi Yoshua says, why should we believe her? Wait a minute. That's not a case of Migo. That was a case of a Chazorka. She doesn't have a Migo. I mean, she's got a little bit of a problem, doesn't she? Hare Kresa Ben Shinea. I mean, she's got a stomach. It's so big that she chomps on it if she's not careful while she's eating a donut. So, therefore, she's got to explain away that stomach. That's not called a Pesha or Migo. There's nothing there. You can't have a better Taina. What better Taina is she going to say? I never slept with anybody. Right, Mother Mary. We understand. You never slept with anybody. So, obviously, over there, there's no Migo. She can't say Lo Nivalti. So, forget about that case. All right. What about the Mishnah of Ra'ua Midaberet Imechad? So we see her with somebody, she's talking to somebody. We ask her, so who's the guy? And she says, oh, he's a great guy. So Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer, I'm in a minute. Rabbi Yoshua, Eimer Lomi Pia Anu Chayim. And you're telling me that the reason that we believe her is because there's a Migo. What's the Migo? I mean, I understand, of course, there's a Migo according to Zahiri. Remember that we had a Machloket over there. What does it mean when it says we see her talking to somebody? So that was a machlokas between Zeiri and Ravasi. Okay, so according to Zeiri, he says midaberet only means we saw her go into a private place with the guy. There she has an ego. She could have said, I never slept with the guy. And then when we ask her, so who's the guy you slept with? How dare you? I never slept with anybody. It was my dear cousin. We come from the same Rabbanish and Mishpacha. So we get a little smile from the Rebbe, maybe. Maybe. Of course, we need to shed some light on his face. But okay, so there she has a Migo, because she could have said, I never slept with the guy. And because of that, so we believe her when she says, I did sleep with the guy, but. But according to Rabasi, who says that it's just a euphemism, and when we say she was speaking to somebody, it means we saw her sleeping with somebody. What could she say? There's witnesses that say that they saw her actually sleeping with him. So what's the Migo over there? So tell me what case Rabbi Yoshua would be saying, I agree that this case is better than Migo. What's the case? No, remember the Mishnah before when we said that she claims she's a Mukat Eitz. And he says, well, maybe you're Drusat Ish. So Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer say that she is Nemenet, and there too Rabbi Yeshua says, Lo Mipia Anuchoyen. So what exactly is the Migu over there? Well, I'll tell you, it depends. There might be a Migu there, but remember that there was a big machlokas about what was the case. Was the case she claims 100 and he claims nothing? Or was the case she claims 200 and he claims 100? Well, that makes a big difference, because if we say that we understand the Mishnah, Aliva de Rebbe Lazar, who says that the Mishnah is talking about a Kala who claims that she deserves a mana because she was a Mukat Eitz, and it's going according to the Rabbanan. Remember, this is the great review. It's going according to Rabbanan, who say that a Mukas Eitz gets 100. Not going according to Rabbi Meir, who says a Mukas Eitz gets 200, right? So then she definitely has a great Migu, because she, instead of saying that when you married me, I was a Mukat Eitz, what she could have said was, listen, buddy, when you married me, I was a 100% Betula. And then after you went ahead and gave me my ring, all of a sudden I had a bike accident and I lost my betulim. It's your problem. The stavcha sadecha, I still get 200. That's what she could have said. And instead she says, well, it's true, I was not a betula, but nobody slept with me. I just had this bike accident, right? So there, you're right. You have a great migo. But according to Rabbi Yochanan, who says the Mishnah over there was going aliba to Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Meir says a mukat eitz has the same din as a bogeret, and that therefore, actually, she gets a full 200. What's the migo? There's no better thing she could have said. She's already tiny that I'm getting 200. So then it's not a good idea either, according to Rabbi Yochanan, the Amar b'matayim v'mona. And that's the argument. What could she have said that's better than matayim? Absolutely nothing. So again, I mean, you're certainly not going to tell me that Rabbi Yeshua is referring back to that Mishnah. Now we have to say that Rabbi Yochanan was off the wall. So this guy, what do you mean when you say that Rabbi Yeshua is referring back to the migu of the previous parak? I'm talking about the Mishnah before that, okay? We started off with a case of Anoseisha, the Lomatzala Bitulim, and she claims, I was raped after you gave me my ring, and therefore your field was flooded away. And he says, well, I don't know that. I mean, maybe this happened before I even gave you a ring, and I ended up taking a woman who was a rape victim. And so over there, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer says she's an emenis, and Rabbi Yeshua says, Lomi pionu choyin. Now over there, we definitely have a migo, because instead of saying she's a rape victim, and there she's going to be always a surah to the kahuna, she would actually been able to say, I was never raped, I was a mukas eight. And I was a mukas eitz tachtecha, where at least that way she remains kasher l'kuhuna, not that she was raped as a married woman. So that's why Rabbi Gamliel said, in that case, we believe her. And Rabbi Yeshua is here coming along and saying, well, Rabbi Yeshua, I've come to understand the issue. You believe in normal migo, which I don't believe in, but I would admit that there certainly is a concept of apesha asra, apesha hitir, even though I argued with you about the migo in the previous parak. And that might be the way to understand the Mishnah. Maybe the Mishnah actually does not imply that necessarily we begin with a statement by Rabbi Gamliel where he's invited to Rabbi Yeshua, and that's the only justification of the end of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yeshua is invited to Rabbi Gamliel. Okay. So, all right. I mean, if that's the case, explain to me, please, why is this migo different than that migo? I mean, if you're telling me that the point over here is that I disagree with the reliability of the migo, which of course is not what we were saying before. Before we were saying that Rabbi Yeshua all along agrees with the migo, okay? And his only problem was that he said that there was a gezeira derabbanan because of mala asu biyuchasim. Now you're coming along and you're saying, oh, forget about the mala asu biyuchasim. And Rabbi Gamliel is looking at the difference between the migo in a case where she could have claimed I was a mukat eitz versus the pesha asra pesha yitir, where a guy says, my house used to belong to your father. Then explain to me. So what's the difference? What's the difference between one migo and the other? I mean, michti, high migo of a high migo. I mean, in both cases, you got a better situation. You made your situation worse by what you said in court or what you said in front of witnesses, right? So why is that any different? Well, it's a big difference, don't you think? In the case of the house or field where you're telling the guy this belonged to your father, there's no shor shachut lefanecha. Is there something that you have to explain away? No. In other words, there's absolutely no basis for a court case. You couldn't have ever walked into a courtroom and said to this guy, hey, what are you doing in my house? That house used to belong to my father. Okay? You don't know anything about it. This is the guy who told you. So that means the entire case is predicated on the one that you've turned into the defendant. I mean, you can't predicate a case on a defendant and then use him against himself, but you don't believe him with the rest of what he said. There, I'm telling you, there's a concept of pesha sarua pesha yitir. Masha'in kein, in the case of a woman who doesn't have any bitulim, I mean, how's she going to explain it? She has to explain it. So there, the way that she's explaining it. So what are you going to tell me? That she could have said a better taina? No, maybe she didn't think of the better taina. I don't hold to that, Migo. Or maybe she's so smart that she figured out that if she says a worse taina, that she looks more believable and more honest. Now, people always think of that idea, right? Well, let me look like I'm a really honest person. Yeah, you're right. I was a rape, but it was at this time. Mashenkin, if she comes along and she's claiming to be Lily White, so then she'll say, why will they? They won't believe me. So I got to at least show that I'm, whatever it is, but I don't believe in these Migos because there's too many fancy ways that people might outthink the Migo or they might underthink the Migo. So how can you rely on a Migo? Good. Okay, maybe that's the shot. But now, why do we need witnesses? I mean, didn't you just tell me that basically it's the equivalent of Bari Vashema? That's what you said. And why is it? Because you said Rov Nashim get married as Betulot. So then why does she have to bring witnesses to the fact that she was a Betula with the Himuna or the Rosh HaParua or the Chiluk Layod? I mean, even if we don't have those witnesses, would we not be able to assume, based on a straight-out rove? And now, the problem is that it might be. Now, remember, we had a machlokas before, that when it comes to Dine Momenes, there's a machlokas Rav and Shmuel about whether holchin b'momen achar rove. Until now, we've been assuming that we're going like Shmuel, who holds Enochim b'momen achar harov. So, okay, the pashtus is, as Tosfos says, that this kasha can only be asked according to Rav. That if you hold Enochim b'momen achar harov, and you have a rov nashim being betulot, so then we don't need witnesses. Answers the Gemara, we still need witnesses. I'll tell you why. Because over here we have a poor rove. That's called, there's a reuta, itra la ruba. There's a reuta in the rove. Oh boy, Moshe Forman isn't here with us. Who's taking over Gavi? You please tell your chavrusa that he's got to include in his list, in his cards, itra la ruba. It's a concept. Fine. I don't even know if he's going to put in Peshas or Peshitra. I'm assuming he will, but just in case. All right, so write it down. Make sure or even type it to him right now. Predicated with the words, you know, Goodnick sleeping in New York in the middle of the night or something like that. Okay. So, says Ravina, this is not a good rove. You know why? Because you're right that rove nashim betulot nisot. But there's still a miut that are almanot, right? Now, put that together and put this in your pipe and smoke it. Point is that when a woman does get married as a betula, the whole way that the wedding is arranged with all of these minhagim and so on is to generate a public perception of the fact that this woman is a betula. Now, somehow or other, it's very strange that we can't find anybody who remembers that she's a betula. So that means that this rov nashim betulot seems not to apply to her. And because of that, itra la ruba, because hove ein lakol, since there is no assumption that she is a betula, and then people say, I don't remember anything special about her wedding. So then that indicates that we cannot go according to the rov, that rov nashim or betulot. Wait a minute. The way you just said that, says the Gemara, there's something wrong with how you said that. You said every woman who gets married as a betula is going to have a kol, every woman is going to have a kol generated that she was a betula. So then forget about Israel Aruba. The very fact that she does not have such a kol is a raya that she is not a betula. So what good is it going to do to bring Aiden? There was no kol. So then if that's the case, e kol and he said betula, yesh la kol, what good is it to have Aiden? We know that these Edom are false because Anan Sahadeh, we know the facts The facts are that there was no colon. You said every time there's every time. I love the way every time. That's like you fight with your wife. Every time. Now, so say it right, okay? It's not every time. It happens. Okay, says Ravina. I got this fight every day. All right, I admit it. It doesn't mean every time. It means most of the time. I can go argue with her about that. But anyway, the rov aniseit betula yesh lakol. So it's one rov against the other rov, and that rov, this was all a semantic question, more or less, right? So you have one rov against the other rov, and now you've weakened the rov, and therefore she needs those witnesses. So this case is rov aniseit yesh lakol. This woman does not have such a call. Therefore, we have a reyesa in the call. And because of that, we're going to need to have witnesses that there was definite attempt at her wedding to generate a kol because she went out with a himuna or with any of the other simanim that she was a betula. Now, I don't understand. Okay, so now we've established this. I don't understand how we're able to collect a ketuvah based on witnesses that she's a betula if she doesn't have a ketuvah. I don't get it. She's coming into court. She's saying, well, I don't have a ketuvah, but there's witnesses. Man, if you don't have a ketuvah, we ain't paying you. Because what's going to prevent you from taking the ketuvah in this court and then going to another town, presenting your get, and this time you present the ketuvah that you supposedly don't have, and now they issue a judgment against your husband, and then what? You know, you've got a great way of collecting a monthly alimony here. You're going to collect one ketuvah a month, you know? How can we make the guy pay you if you're not giving him back the contract? That doesn't make any sense. Dilma mafka edim b'hai beit din avagavya. So maybe she'll bring her edim to this bezdin claiming she lost her ketuvah. And then she'll go to another bezdin. She'll present her ketuvah and she'll be gavya ba. Now she'll use the ketuvah to actually collect again. Omer Rabbi Abo, from here we see a very important halacha, which is a big machloket elsewhere. Do we force a person to accept a receipt? She says, listen, I will write you out a shover. A shover is a receipt that breaks. It's called a shover because it breaks your ability to utilize the contract against the recipient of the receipt. Now, that guy says, what do you mean you're going to give me a receipt? And what happens if I lose the receipt? Now, all of a sudden, it's my responsibility. You had a ksuva. Either you give me that ksuva or I'm not paying you. I don't want to take a receipt. Who knows? What if there's a fire? What if somebody steals the receipt? What if I lose the receipt? That's not fair. I wrote you a shtar. Give me back the shtar. Now, this is a big machlokas. Can we first force someone to accept a receipt against his will and need to keep that receipt for the next 50 years because who knows when she's going to come along with a claim that now she found her ksuva and she never collected it? Must be that we do that, says Rabbi Abo. And we force him, even though he was the one who lent the money, we force him to take a receipt. Rav Papa says, no, we don't do that. How can we do that? It's got to be talking about a location where they do not write a ksuva. Remember, we talked about this. A ksuva is a tnai d'rabbana that defines the nature of every marriage. So even if there's no ktuva at all, the ktuva is still binding. In a place where you write a ktuva, so then of course you can only keep her when you wrote the ktuva. But if you're in a place where everyone relies on the fact that there would be a ktuva unless otherwise explained away, so then we never write a ktuva because we don't want to have the whole problem. So then she'll collect on the basis of witnesses, you know, and we'll see later on. So I understand. So what prevents her from going ahead and collecting again if you say you don't write a shover? That we'll talk about. But that's what we're talking about over here. It says, Rav Papa, there is no ksuva. Okay, fine. But the problem is that we do have a brisa of this whole discussion between Rav Papa, who says, no, we can't force you to take a shover, and Rabbi Abo, who says, we can. The same exact discussion, according to some, was said about a brisa, and the brisa includes additional material, which makes it very problematic to maintain Rav Papa, who's claiming that we're talking about a place where there is no ksuva. Because in the brisa, listen to what it says in the brisa. In the brisa, it says, ibda ktuvata. Uh-oh, didn't say that in the Mishnah. The brisa says, if she lost her ktuva, or if she hid her ktuva, or if her ktuva was burnt up. So then, the halacha is like this. If they danced at a wedding, we'll see what that means, why dancing at the wedding is done for a betula. Ketzer meraktim, which is tomorrow's daf. So then, fine. Or, if sichaku lefaneha, what if they juggled in front of her? Whatever stuff they do, whatever shtick they do at the wedding. Or, if havir lefaneha, kos shel besura, we're going to be talking about what all these things are later. It's not important for us at this moment. Or they bring the sheet with her betulim to dance around her, and that shows that she's a betulim. Things were different once upon a time. And what today are big hang-ups were just indications of normal human behavior once upon a time. So they dance around with the mapa, the betulim. What a wonderful girl. Im yeshla edim be'echad mikolele. So if she's got witnesses to any of these things, k'tuvata mataim. Now, based on this brayta, obviously it's going to be very difficult for Rav Papa to say, we're talking about a place where there is no ktuva. If she said she lost the ktuva, or the ktuva was burnt up, so something is funny over here. But okay, fine. So we asked the same question, the same conversation. Listen, Rebbe Baruch Hashem, the Zoom has placed the Gabbai right next to you. There's a reason for that, and that is because the Gabbai it took apparently all the simcha from the Rebbe. It's supposed to be the Rebbe's job to be the one who is mole simcha, so when the Hasidim walk in, they immediately get his eiros and so on. And the reason Zoom put Gavi next to you is in order to get some of that Gavi simcha into you so that you can go back to being a Rebbe with a big smile. Now get to work, man. You're liable to lose your position. It's a very serious problem. You can put a little smile on, but that's not enough. Okay, got to get to work. So, okay, we got a smile. So, in this case, the Gemara asks the same question. So, all of this is about Gavi. So, let's be worried that maybe she'll come and she'll collect with Adam, and then Gavi will, she'll bring her ksuvah to another bezdin, and she'll be Gaiva in that bezdin. Same question, and the same answer. Rabbi Abbo says, oh, there's no explanation other than we have to bite the bullet. Zot omeret kotvim shover. But here, too, Rav Papa claims, now here, very difficult to support Rav Papa's claim. Rav Papa says, now nah, we're talking about a place where there's no ksuva. What? The price says she lost her ksuva. What do you mean we're talking about a place where there's no ksuva? It says, ibda ktuvata. So how can Rav Papa say we're talking about a place where they don't write a ksuva? Well, he happened to write a ksuva, but it was a place where they don't write a ksuva. So who cares? And the bottom line is we agreed that there was a ksuva. So fine, it's the same question. Bottom line, sov. Mafka lavagavyaba. So what's your explanation? Says Rav Papa, well, when it says she lost her ksuva, it doesn't mean she lost her ksuva. It means there was a fire that burnt up her ksuva, and we have witnesses, and therefore she can't use her ksuva again. Excuse me, Rav Papa, but there are two separate cases. One case is she lost her ksuva, and the other case is that the ksuva was burnt up. So, no, when it means she lost in the fire? So then why does it say nisrafa? And what are you going to do about the other case? Hitmina, she hid her ksuva. She hid her ksuva? Now, listen, all of you guys know that if your wife said she lost something, there's a chance that she'll find it. But if your wife says, I hid it, it will not be recovered until there's an archaeological dig in the house, right? So, I mean, it could be, who knows, centuries until it's found. I mean, those are the words of absolute death. I hid it. No. You might as well just order another one. So in this case, she hid it. Okay. But anyway, I mean, aren't we worried that maybe there'll be an archaeological dig and she'll recover her ksuva? I mean, it's so, I don't get it. How are you able to pay up? And anyway, besides that, obviously there's a ksuva there. And then why would I need the case of ibda if, this way Tosfos understands the question, if you're telling me that ibda means nisrafa, ibda ktuvata nisrafa, so then leave out the words ibda, just say nisrafa. Why are we mentioning ibda? So therefore, Rav Papa cannot get away with claiming that we're talking about a place where there's no ksuva. Therefore, we need to really kvetch. Oh boy, you got a good shorn. We can shorn Rav Papa's pshat into the brisa if we're ready to say that the words hitmina, this is like really a big shoehorn. That what it really says is, well, if she says ibdaktu vata, you know, or nisrafa, that would be the same thing as watching her hide that ksuva, knowing that she's going to take it out of hiding and presenting it to another bezdin. In which case, we won't give her a penny because she cannot produce her ksuva. Only if there are witnesses that it was burned, then we can pay her up. That's what the brides are saying. So lo yavina la, it's as if itmina befaneinu dami, and we won't give her a dime unless we have witnesses that say it was burned. That's the meaning, says Rav Papa, as this brisa. Yes, indeedy. The whole point of the brisa was to prove that Rav Papa is right and that we'll never give a woman a dime unless we know why there is no ksuva. Ha-ha. I turned the tables. Yeah, if you've got a good shoehorn, you turn the tables. Okay. So Rav Papa now is claiming it fits into there. Now, I just want to point out to you that if you have, like we originally said, this whole discussion with Rabbi Avon and Rav Papa built around the Mishnah, so then in that case, you're not going to have the guts to say it about the Brisa, because who knows if you got a good enough shoehorn. So if you go according to that first way of learning it, that it was said about the Brisa, I mean, the second way, he said about the brides, Kolshik and I would have this conversation, would make perfectly good sense on the Mishnah. We would be talking about a place where there's no ksuva. But if you have it built around the Mishnah, the way our first approach was, you wouldn't say it about the Braita, because there's too many kashas that we have that to believe Rav Papa's explanation, there's no way he's going to get away with claiming it's in the Braita. Okay, fine. Now, you said that if there are 8 a.m., then the ksuva is 200. I don't understand why we don't have the same problem. The whole problem that you made was a problem of using the ktuva afterwards to collect in another bezdin. What do you mean using a ktuva afterwards? Why can't you just use Adim afterwards? I don't get it. If you can collect in one bezdin using Adim that you're a betula, then what's to prevent you from going into another bezdin, claiming you never collected the ktuva, and then you get a ktuva matayim, and that you come from a place where they don't write a ktuva? How do you stop that? So why are we only talking about presenting the ktuva? Lechash dilma mafka edei numa b'hai beidina v'gavya, and then other mafka edei numa b'hai beidina b'dina achrina v'gavya. No, it's this we mentioned before. The Gemara is going to have to explain this. How can you collect a ktuva in a place where they won't write a ktuva? Well, there, says Gemara, obviously, if the original takana is that you can collect a ktuva, and you're in a place where they don't even write a ktuva, then part of the takana that you can collect a ktuva is that we force a husband who divorces and pays a ktuva to accept the shover. Everybody agrees to that, that if there is no other way to have this relationship, of course you write a shover. We're talking about a case where there's an alternative. Give me back the shtar. But if the original takon is there is no shtar, of course, koleyama, mokum dolo efshar, of course, vanekat vina shover. Otherwise, we can't even discuss the whole takon of eksuva, silly. That wasn't where Rabbi Avo and Rav Papa are arguing. Okay, so we have this very important machlokas. Gavi, please give it over to Moshe. Katvinan shover. Whether we force somebody to accept the shover or not, and to include this idea, mokum dolo efshar, over there we will write a shover. All right, what are these things, by the way? They brought a kosho bisura. What is a kosho bisura? Well, says Rada Barava, we take truma out of a big barrel that says truma on it. We pour it into a cup, and we present this kosho and walk all around the chasen and kala with this cup. And that is klomar. What we're trying to say is, see this girl? She could even eat truma, if you were a Kohen. So, in other words, there is no problem about her. There'd be no chashash that she's potzol. She was never nivellet. Matkifla rokpa, but that's stupid. And what are you telling me? And if she was an almona, she can't have truma. Come off it. I mean, an almona is allowed to have truma. You can do anything wrong in becoming an almona. Let's talk about a kohen gadol. That can't be what it is. Elomer of Papa, the simon of truma is totally different. Truma is defined as rachis. That's the beauty of truma. So in the same way that this truma is called rachis, this girl is pure rachis. The first time she's ever had a lover. It's yours forever. The world will always welcome lovers. That's it, because it goes back to rachis. Beautiful. Okay, so Zureishis, Kamosha Truma Reishis. Now, Rabbi Yehuda says that wasn't the minhag. The minhag was that they would take a whole fresh barrel of wine. Remember, the barrels were barrels of cheres. And they would bring the barrel, and it would depend on whether she was a betula or not, what kind of barrel. So in the case of betula, they brought a closed barrel. And that was an indication that she was a betula, the same way that this barrel of wine is closed. Remember that wine and betulot have a lot to do with each other, even in terms of deciding if she is a betula. And remember all of the Gemaras we had in Nida, that it's the similarity of dam to yayin. And so there's a lot of issues. Gal na'ul, the idea of the yirok dota, the micholot pekerem. There's many, many questions. Women and wine go together. Back in Gan Eden, we have women and wine. This is not a small issue, but in any event, so we're going to show what kind of woman this is by having a sealed barrel of wine. But if she's a bu'ula, then we're going to bring around an open barrel of wine so everyone should know the truth. Ah, come on, that's not nice. I mean, what do we got to bring an open barrel of wine to insult the bu'ula? I mean, I understand you want to bring a closed barrel of wine to make it nice for the betula. Do you have to go out of your way to embarrass the bu'ula? Don't bring any wine for a bu'ula. You got to bring an open barrel of wine. Bikami bu'ula, lo neil klal. You want to bring a bottle of wine for a betula? That's all very sweet. No, says the Gemara, because then if we would do that, what happens if this woman goes and steals 200 mana, 200 zuz rather, from her husband's, who divorced her's house, okay? Now he comes and he says, you stole that money. I didn't steal that money. That was the money you owed me for my ketuvah. But you weren't a betula. Of course I was a betula. Prove I wasn't a betula. So now we're trying to get the money out of her hand, right? So then he says, well, what do you mean? I can prove you weren't a betula. There was no barrel of wine passed around. Of course there was no barrel of wine passed around, you jerk, says she. You were dead drunk along with all your friends. You couldn't even stand up straight. How were you going to bring the wine? So it was all about idnuseitness. It was because you never got around to it. What does that prove? I want proof positive that I was only owed 100. If not, I keep this money. Okay, so because of that, we have to have a positive sign in which the husband would be able to say, I can prove it. That's very good. She has him over a barrel. I like that one. Even I figured it out. Very nice. Very, very nice. I wonder if this is the mucker of the entire... must be. It's a burr. What does having someone over a barrel have to do with forcing him to pay? It's got to be this Gemara. Amazing. Wonderful.